dreary weeknight evening during the mad pre-Hanukkah rush will join us for part two of the Neil Dubinsky Memorial Lecture Series. The final lecture is going to be in the form of a Malav Malka, which Rabbi Moshe Targum will be speaking on the topic of Mima Makin, Tefillah from the Depths of Experience. That's Motzei Shabbat, December the 11th. The Malav Malka starts at 7 p.m., and the speaker will be approximately 7:30. We have the pleasure and honor of welcoming Rabbi Kenneth Brander, who is the inaugural dean of the Center for the Jewish Future at Yeshiva University. A little over 7 years ago, President Richard Joel became the president of Yeshiva University with the dream of expanding YU's reach as a force of chesed, Torah education, and building a community throughout the U.S. and throughout the world. He accomplished this by joining forces with Rabbi Kenneth Brander and together creating the Center for the Jewish Future. Since then, the CJF has shaped, enriched, and inspired the contemporary Jewish community by convening the resources of yeshiva, infusing the student body with the spirit of leadership and a sense of Klal Yisrael. CJF serves to build, cultivate, and support communities, rabbinic and lay leaders, and individuals. I consider myself personally as a rabbinic leader, a beneficiary of many of the programs of the CJF. Rabbi Brander is Rabbi Emeritus of the Boca Raton Synagogue, founding dean of the Boca Raton Community Kollel, the founder of the Weinbaum Yeshiva High School of Broward and Palm Beach Counties. During his 14 years of service to the community in Boca Raton, he oversaw its explosive growth from 60 families to 600 families. Rabbi Brander is a 1984 alumnus of Yeshiva College, received his ordination from Meats in 1986. And besides his distinctions as a student and dean in YU, the most important point of distinction for tonight is that he was a classmate and friend of Neil Dubinsky. Alav HaShalom, also completed a distinguished education at YU. I want to recognize the presence of Schwartz and Dubinsky families, in particular Mia's mother, and sister, Bertha Dubinsky, and of course his brother, Harry Dubinsky, and all the family members who have come this morning. May the Torah we learn tonight be a source of Aliyah for Neil's Shalom.
It's such a pleasure to be in Rabbi Septimus' synagogue and to really see the work that he's doing. The thing that happened when I walked in here is that two different people were going to me to tell me how great a job he's doing. That's wonderful to hear, and we wish the community continued strength as it grows. Ms. Michael Lachael, should the Dubinsky family. You know, this morning, as I was reviewing my notes, I actually took out my high school yearbook, although I think Neil graduated a year later. There are several pictures in my high school yearbook, me and Neil doing different things together. And some of them are what I would call proper pictures, and some of them are goofy pictures. But, there's smiles from both the goofy and the proper pictures in the yearbook. It just reminded me once again the energy and the character that Neil represented. He went through different metamorphoses, at least the times that I knew him. In high school, he was, wore a jacket and a hat during davening. In college, it was a slightly different demeanor, but the meta-narrative of Neil was always one of chesed, one who represented the notion of acts of loving kindness, who was committed to chesed, who was committed to helping other people, who cared for other people. The last time I saw him in an engaging way was there was a YU reunion where I think our, it probably makes sense, it was our 25th or something like that, graduation. I can't be 25th. Less than that, 10 years, or 25th, I don't remember where it was. Neil and I were both at this graduation dinner together, We sat next to each other, schmoozed a little bit together. And again, it was, the conversations were punctuated with issues of chesed, being concerned about others. And when we talked about some of the things that we were doing in this new center that's 5 years old, Neil's first thing was focused on the idea that the students should get out and be involved in the community, both the Jewish community and the larger community. And he was appreciative of that type of engagement. And so tonight's topic is appropriate on two levels. The obvious, why bad things happen to good people, finding our response to adversity and tragedy. But there, I think there is a not an appropriate reason for this topic, not only for the obvious reason, but because I believe the response to this question, when bad things happen to good people, is an answer, a response that is cloaked in the notion of chesed. And if there's anything that Neil represented in his life, or what I saw, was the whole notion of chesed, of acts of loving kindness. Tonight, I'd like to divide my presentation into two parts. The first is dealing with tragedy from a community perspective. How does the community respond to tragedy? And I'd like to focus on also when adversity happens to an individual and how one deals with that. So I think the tragedy and adversity for the community and personal is slightly different, and I'd like to speak to both of them. It's interesting that if you look through the Talmud, you'll see that there are several of the books of Tanakh that at certain times the rabbis were thinking of removing from Tanakh and putting in Geniza, removing them from Tanakh because they represented certain challenges. So the Gemara, for example, in Avos D'Rav Nasan, the Masechta of Avos D'Rav Nasan, says that Berishona, in the beginning, they wanted to take Mishlei, Shir HaShirim, and Koheles, and they actually, Genuzenheim, they were removed from the book canonized text. And only at the time of the Anshei Knesset Nagadola, of the Great Assembly of Rabbis, were they then reintroduced. And there's a Gemara in Shabbos that also speaks about the idea regarding Kohelet and Mishlei, that they wanted to remove it. Why? Because Kohelet and Mishlei are filled with various parables. There are sometimes contradictory statements, at least on the surface, in the Tanakh. And so therefore there is this issue that they wanted to remove it from the canonized text. And why is Shir HaShirim discussed, the Song of Songs? Because it represents a romantic relationship between God and the Jewish people. And some people were concerned with the fact that there was this very overtly text that speaks about the romantic interaction between two lovers, namely God and the Jewish people. And so there was this conversation regarding removing Mishlei, Shir HaShirim, and Kohelet because they were controversial in nature. But what's interesting is that Eo, the book of Job, and Echa, the book which questions, there's no discussion about removing Job and Echa and the book that we read on the night of Tisha B'Av from the canonized text. And I always wondered about that. Why is it that when it comes to Shir HaShirim and Kohelet and Mishlei, which, you know, have some parables and maybe some conflicting statements, why is it? Is my moving around going to mess you up?
Not at all.
I always move around.
Not
so
at all.
Sorry.
It's great.
Why is it that means that anyone who watches this is going to have to take some time and move forward? Why is it that the rabbis were thinking about discarding because they were difficult to understand? And the book of Job, which speaks in great detail, great depth about the whole notion of theodicy, of why bad things and when bad things happen to good people, and Echa, which questions God, why is there no conversations in the Talmud regarding removing those texts? And I think that it really celebrates an important idea, and that is that we have the right to explore the issue of why bad things happen to good people and when bad things happen to good people, how to deal with it. I think that's the message. In other words,
and comes to Shir HaShirim. It's controversial. Song of Songs, a romantic relationship between God and the Jewish people. Mishlei, Kohelet, difficult passages to understand. So there was a movement at times to remove them from the canonized text. But Iyov, as controversial, as difficult, as challenging as it is, no one ever wants to remove it from the canonized text, because the bottom line is that we always, at times in our lives, ask the question of why difficult things happen to good people. And I find there to be another idea that Rabbi Soloveitchik speaks about, and that is found in the Sechet Bava Batra, the tractate of Bava Batra, beginning on the 14th page, where the Gemara speaks about who wrote the various books of Tanakh. And it says that, you know, Yoshua wrote his book at the last 8 verses of the Torah. Shmuel wrote his book, as well as Shoftim and Rut. David wrote Tehillim with some help from a list that the Gemara mentions. Yirmiyahu wrote his book, and the book of Melachim, as well as the book of Eicha. And then the Gemara discusses, what about Iyov? Who wrote the book of Iyov? Or when did Iyov live? So one shita, one school of thought in the Gemara is that Iyov lived in the time of Moshe. One then school of thought is, no, Iyov lived in the time of Isaac. Another group is that Iyov lived in the time of Jacob. Another group is that lived in the time of Joseph. Another group is that lived during the time of the spies. And then there's actually a school of thought, Shmuel Bar Nachmeni, which says, Iyov lo hayav lo nivra. He never lived at all. And then there's another group that speaks about that Iyov was from the group that returned from exile. And the bottom line is, there's no consensus of who Iyov was. So Rabbi Soloveitchik asked the wonderful question. He said, why is it that every other book of the text, all the other books of Tanakh, we know exactly who wrote them. The Gemara is very definite in establishing who wrote it. When it comes to Iyov, we're not sure when he lived, time of Avram, Yitzhak, Yaakov, Yosef, Moshe. Maybe Iyov didn't exist, maybe he lived later. Rabbi Soloveitchik said that there's no argument here. He says beautifully that the message that the Gemara is trying to give to us is that there is an Iyov in each and every one of us. There's an Iyov in every generation. That each and every one of us, you know, lives with Jobian challenges. That each and every one of us deals with these issues. That there's an Iyov in every generation. There are those that went through the Shoah who live with the Iyov paradigm. There are those who lose loved ones. There are those who lose children that go through the Iyov issues. There are those who go through significant challenges in life, questions in which one has in some ways the need to ask, you know, why bad things happen to good people. And it's a recognition of the fact that there is an Iyov in every generation. And Iyov didn't live in one particular time. And he's not just one particular person. Iyov, there's a piece of Iyov in each and every one of us. We all carry around the piece of Iyov within our lives. And that, in some ways, becomes the point of departure in discussing tragedy for the community. But how do we deal with tragedy when it happens for the community? Again, as I said in my introduction, that I think there's two different issues here, personal tragedy and community tragedy. I want to spend the first few minutes focusing first on community tragedy. And I think that the message regarding community tragedy is first and foremost the idea that I just articulated. And that is that the reason why Chazal never challenged why Eicha, how could it happen, or Iyov, why bad things happen to good people, is never removed from the Tanakh. It is a recognition of the fact that these are difficult questions, but one that every generation and every person struggles with. And this becomes a lift-off point in a modern contemporary time to discuss the Shoah. You know, there are some that suggest that as a result of the Shoah, that one cannot continue to believe in God. After all, if there's a God, how can there have been such a thing as 6 million plus Jews being murdered? And then you have those like professors and philosophers like Fackenheim, who has suggested that there's now a 614th biblical commandment, and not to give Hitler a posthumous victory.
the need to engage in belief, the need to engage in observance, because God forbid that what Hitler couldn't do, we should allow to happen after Hitler's death. And then there are others who suggest, well, in order to deal with why these bad things happen to the Jewish people, we have to give reasons. The past Satmar Rebbe, Zatzal, who says that the reason for the Shoah was because of the Zionists. Or the Zionists who suggested the reason for the Shoah, or some Zionists who suggested the reason for the Shoah is because Israel was neglected. That people said that you should live in Poland. In fact, there were people who said Poland, that Poland means Po, here, Lin, that you should live. And you shouldn't go to Israel. And there are others who said Mipnei Chataenu, because of the great defections that there was from Torah. The fact that Jews were involved in all the isms, materialism and communism and Buddhism and all the isms of that generation, of that time. And I have to tell you that all of these reasons given, the reason by the former Satmar Rebbe, the reason by certain Zionists, the reason by certain Hasidic and Litvish leaders, to suggest that there is a particular reason for the Shoah bothers me greatly. After all, how could anybody suggest that there was a sin that was great enough, large enough, intense enough to be commensurate with such a punishment? We, by definition, throughout Jewish history, there isn't the generation after a tragedy happens never gives the reason for a tragedy happening to the Jewish community. Sometimes there are things we can learn. So a few generations after the destruction of the Second Temple, there's a conversation about perhaps there was baseless hatred that caused the destruction of the temple. But the group that immediately leaves and is destroyed during that period of time does not give a particular answer. Because it's repulsive for us, and I mean that in the strongest of terms, it's repulsive to give an answer, a particular answer, why a great tragedy happens to the Jewish people. And when Moshe turns to the Jewish people, when they're in the desert and they're complaining about the adversity of having no water, and he calls them Shimuna Hamorim, he calls them the rebellious ones. What happens to Moshe? What happens to Moshe? He loses his ability to continue to be the leader. And when Eliyahu says, Kano Kinesi Lashem Elokei Tzivakot, he complains to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that the Jewish people have abandoned God. Ki azvu britecha, they have abandoned your brit, they've abandoned your covenantal relationship. Immediately after that, Eliyahu's Talmud, Eliyahu's student, has to take over for him. And that is why Eliyahu has to come to every single brit. He spoke bad about the Jewish people. We don't speak bad about the Jewish people. And because he spoke bad about the Jewish people, he needs to come to every brit to remind him that the covenant still exists. In fact, even in the Torah portions that we're reading, the first diaspora experience, the first experience where God is hidden from the Jewish people, the story of Yosef, is about the challenge happens when one Jew speaks out against another Jew. And so I think the first thing that we need to recognize is the fact that simplistic approaches to great tragedies need to be rejected. That someone could suggest that the reason why September 11th happened is because people's sleeve lengths are not the appropriate length. I think, again, compromises the ability to look at these issues, I think, with greater clarity. And the recognition of the fact that we need to look at the paradigms that Chazal has given us, the paradigm like Eov, that Eov recognized that he simply did not understand. He did not understand what happened to him. And as a Kaddish Baruch who engages in dialogue with Eov, he says, you will not understand. You do not understand the cosmos issues. You were not around when I created the world. You don't understand the basics. Don't ask to understand the more challenging issues. And when Moshe Rabbeinu says, Hareini nas kvodecha, allow me to understand your kvodecha, allow me to understand your glory. Chazal translate that as saying, allow me to understand why bad things happen to good people. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, human beings cannot understand that. You'll be able to see maybe from a distance You'll be able to see after a generation or two why certain things happen. But you will not understand the reason. That is something that is only within the hands of the divine, and we simply cannot understand that. And I think it's important to recognize that while where we are in diaspora, there is this notion of hester panim, that God hides himself from us, there are times in which God realizes that his face must be clairvoyant in order to guarantee the immortality of the Jewish people. And so therefore, while I would never suggest that the state of Israel is a prize for the Holocaust happening, and almost to suggest that's a good enough reason for the Holocaust happening, I don't think that that's the case either. But I do think that the state of Israel represents almost a form of divine revelation to ensure that a Holocaust could never happen again to the Jewish community. And that we need to sometimes look for what I would call the face of God, the glory of God, that happens even in the dark times. It's interesting that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu, when God creates mankind, humankind, he does not in that pasuk say, Ki Tov, because it is good. Because ultimately it is humankind that decides with the free will that each and every one of us has, whether we please God or whether we displease God. Freedom of choice is what makes us human beings. Paro, at one point in time, loses his free choice. By Yechazaka Hashem et Lev Paro, God hardens his heart. God takes away the notion of free choice from Paro. But we have to realize the notion of doing good is devoid of virtue if there is no evil in the world. You know, Viktor Frankl, who is the survivor of two concentration camps and has written some extremely important books, if you have not read them, it pays to read, writes in one of his books, and only someone who has survived two concentration camps has the right to say this, Theresienstadt and Auschwitz, has the right to say that he would rather a world in which there's a Hitler, because sometimes people use free will in an incorrect, inappropriate, despicable way, if at the same time what happens is there can be saints and tzaddikim, righteous and pious people, who use free will in a positive way. That it is free will that defines who we are, and it's free will that is so critical in recognizing how we can engage within society. Elie Wiesel, when he was freed from concentration camps, had a conversation with Rav Silver, one of the great religious leaders of the time. And Elie Wiesel had decided that he did not want to have anything to do with Judaism anymore. And the reason that he told Rabbi Silver he didn't want to have anything to do with Judaism anymore was because he said that he witnessed a person who had a sitter in his concentration camp bunk and would only allow other Jews to use that sitter if they gave them half a piece of their bread ration for the day. And Elie Wiesel said, what type of God could there be if somebody who owns a sitter won't lend it for free, but demands half of a quarter of a slice of bread that a person got in order to be able to look at the sitter? And Rabbi Silver so wisely turned to Elie Wiesel, and Elie Wiesel writes how this changed his whole life. How he turns to him, and he says to him, why are you looking at the person who had the sitter and defining your Judaism based on that person? Why aren't you looking at all of the people who cared so much about a communication with God, having a rendezvous with God even in the darkest of moments, they were actually willing to give up their piece of bread in order to be able to engage in a relationship with God. The fact that there's actually responsa literature that speaks about shilas, if somebody's allowed to build a sukkah during the Holocaust when they stole wood from the Nazis, whether that's a sukkah gezula, a stolen sukkah, and is it permitted for me to do that? The fact that there's a shaila when inmates in Auschwitz would light Hanukkah candles simply using some machine oil and thread from their tattered clothing, whether they're supposed to say Shachiyanu v'kiyamanu v'giyanu l'azman hazeh, thanking God that they've reached this auspicious occasion. The fact that Jews are willing to use their free will to connect to God speaks about sometimes the light that happens in times of darkness. And I would suggest that the meta-narrative that we need to talk about when we speak about evil is not why bad things happen to good people, because I don't think we have the capacity to answer that question. And that's what the whole book of Eo is about. I think the conversation is a slightly different one, and that is, when bad things happen to good people, how do we react? Viktor Frankl shows us in the whole series of psychotherapy that he developed, actually, that he wrote when he was in the concentration camps. He speaks about the notion of us using our free will. And although it's an important work, we don't need Viktor Frankl to remind us, Abriut, about this idea, about the centrality of free will, that it's when bad things happen to good people, how we define ourselves. The fact that there were Jews who were willing still to pray, the fact that there were Jews who were concerned about Hanukkah candles, the fact that there were Jews who were concerned about living meaningful and moral lives, to me speaks about the beauty of the human condition, even in times of difficulty. And we have another sefer in Tanakh that tells us about when bad things happen to good people, how we respond. And that's the sefer known as Megillas Esther. Megillas Esther is a sefer in which God's name is not found, not even once. You can't find God's name in there. It's hinted, it's mentioned. If you look at, if you have a good Megillah, HaMelech is the beginning of each column of parchment in your Megillah. But the bottom line is, it is the capacity of Esther and Mordechai to recognize that if they are silent when bad things are happening to good people, and they don't speak truth to power, and they're not willing to engage, and they're not willing to make a difference, and they're not willing to fight against adversity, and they're not willing to find the light in the dark moments and create light out of that darkness. If they're not willing to do that, then as Mordechai tells Esther, Rabach v'hatzala yamod mimakom acher, then there will be somebody else who'll do it. What makes Mordechai and Esther unique, and what makes the Sefer of Megillas Esther unique, is it teaches us, when bad things happen to good people, how are we supposed to respond? We're supposed to create lights within this world. We're supposed to find, even in the darkness, we're supposed to find light. And that's why the Baalei Kabbalah, and not only Baalei Kabbalah, but great Gedolim like Rav Huttner and Achad Yitzchak and others, have actually an interesting thing. They translate, and this is more on, you know, it's not literal translation, but it represents a mystical Kabbalistic idea. And that is, they translate the word for the Day of Atonement, Yom HaKippurim. They translate it as Yom HaKippurim, or Yom Kippurim, as Yom, a day, Ki, like, Purim. The Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year, the day in which we don't wear masks, the day in which we don't play with a grogger, the day in which we don't even eat. We say that Yom Kippur, Yom Kippurim, is translated as a day like Purim. How could that be? There's no two more opposite days of the year than Yom Kippurim and Purim. But there's a larger message that our rabbis are trying to communicate to us. That is, if on Yom Kippur, on this Day of Atonement, we're willing to take our destiny and realize that we can change the world around us, then we are celebrating the messages of what Purim is all about. If we can just for a moment, on a Day of Atonement, for one moment, capture the energy of Mordechai and Esther and realize that within all the darkness of our life, all the challenges in our life, all the difficulties in our life, that we can still find the light to change the destiny of the world, to change the fate of the Jewish people, then we will celebrate what Yom Kippur is all about. And therefore, the rabbis say, if you truly want to understand the deep, deep message of Yom Kippurim, realize the translation of Yom Kippurim is a day like Purim, where we can tap into the energy of personalities like Mordechai and Esther, who were about to be obliterated. Mordechai was about to be hung. But his question was not why bad things happened to him. He recognized when these challenges happen, it's our responsibility to be able to find light within the darkness. It's why the Rambam in a very strong statement, writes the following things about Purim, about the Megillas Esther. Kol Sifrei HaNeviim B'chol HaKtuvim Atidim Lihibatel Limot HaMashiach. All the books of Nach, all the books of the prophets, will no longer be of significant consequence in the time of Mashiach. Chutz Megillat Esther, Hari Hikayemet K'chamishah Chumshei Torah. For it will exist like the five books of Moses. The rest of the books, Yoshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, Malachim, Mishlei, even Eov, none of those books will be of significant importance. The only ones will be the five books of the Torah and Megillas Esther. Maybe that's one of the reasons why we don't study Tanakh, because we think Mashiach is coming soon, and therefore we don't need to study it. Not a good enough excuse. Harehi kayemis kechamishin kumshei Torah. Why? Ukehilchot shel Torah shebal peh, and obviously the tradition of the Talmud, she'enam betelin ma'olam. Because they will be there forever. Why is it that the book of Esther, the book which does not have the name of God in it, is the book that remains in the time of the Mashiach? And books like Yoshua and Shoftim, Shmuel, Malachim, Mishlei, Kohelet, which have the name of God on every other page, according to the Rambam, will no longer have the same significance as it has now. And I think we've answered that question. I think what the Rambam is trying to tell us is, how do you bring Mashiach? How do you bring light in this dark world? How do you transform the reality? When we borrow the messages that are found in the book of Esther, when we have the capacity to recognize that when bad things happen to the Jewish people, what defines the moments are the people who are willing still to create light, even in those moments of darkness. And so, I share with you as part of my introduction, and I'm only going to speak for a few more minutes and we'll take some questions, that I believe that that Chazal were very careful. They were careful not to say there was only one author of Eov, but suggest that Eov lives in every generation. They were careful to suggest that perhaps Eov doesn't exist in any one person, Lohaya v'lo Nivra, but exists in each and every one of us. The Chazal realized that what defines us as human beings is the free will that we have, that even in the darkness of community challenges and tragedy, what defines us is the capacity to create light even in those darkness. It is why Yom Kippurim is translated by the Kabbalistic rabbis and Kabbalistic tradition as a day like Purim, because it is Purim that represents that. It is why the Rambam writes this unbelievably strong statement regarding the holiness of the book of Esther, that in the time of the Mashiach, it will become the preeminent book of the prophets and will be on an equal status to the five books of the Torah. It reminds us that our response to adversity and tragedy is is to ask ourselves the question, not why bad things happen, but when they happen, the capacity to bring light within the world. It's interesting that one of the great Hasidic masters, in his trying to struggle with a pasuk in Yirmiyahu, where the pasuk in Jeremiah says, "Bamistarim tifken nafshi," in the hidden space, God says, "My soul cries." What does that mean? In the hidden space, God's soul cries. And the Hasidic master says the following. He gives a certain parable to understand this. He says that, you know, he tells a story about a grandfather who is playing, that his grandson asks to play hide and seek with him. And what happens is the grandfather starts counting, the grandson runs to play and is hiding. And as the grandfather's about to look for him, there's someone who knocks at the door. And the grandfather gets involved with the person who knocked at the door. And a few minutes later, He hears his grandchild crying in a little corner hiding. The grandfather walks over to him and says, "Why are you crying?" And he says, "I'm crying because I was hiding and no one went to look for me." Says the Hasidic master, "Bamistarim tivken nafshi," that God in a hidden place cries, because sometimes when God is hiding, when God is in a corner, when it's hard to find God, when something happens to us as a community, when something happens to us as individuals, that's the time in which we truly need to look for God. And if we have the charisma and the courage to find Him, then we can create light within this world. It helps calibrate our souls. It allows us, even in the darkest of dark times, to be able to dispel the darkness through the light we can create through our own free will. And let me share with you this issue on a more personal level of how we deal with adversity and tragedy when it happens to us personally. I cannot compare, nor am I attempting to compare, the challenges that Neil's family has to deal with his loss. A special young man who had grown up and was successful and was engaging, and all of a sudden, at the time within his life, was taken away from his family, was taken away from us. And I'm not attempting with this story that I'm going to share with you to compare two situations, but I'd like to share with you a personal story and to discuss with you a way in which I think, on a personal level, one gets through and over adversity. 16 years ago, we were blessed in the summer with a daughter. She was born, she was wonderful, she was great. My wife was in the hospital, it was the summer, I was taking care of the home. Called her a few times to ask her where the milk and fleishik was, as my father will tell you, I still don't know where the milk and fleishik is. And I use paper. And the bottom line is that I'm taking my kids to school. It's 2 days after my wife gives birth, and she calls me up that the baby has been taken to the NICU, to the neonatal intensive care unit. And I wasn't so concerned about it. As a rabbi, I've been to the NICU way too many times. That's just the opposite. It just makes sure the baby's being watched better. But I went to the hospital, obviously, and we had found, and our daughter went from bad to worse. A few hours later, she was actually taken to another hospital in Hollywood. The trauma team was flown from around South Florida by helicopter and some by plane to do something called ECMO, which is a pretty invasive procedure, which basically allows all of the inner organs to rest while the blood is removed from the carotid artery, cleaned, and then put back so the inner organs can take a rest while the body is going through shock. And the situation was such that my daughter, our young baby, did not recover, and she passed away. And having children at home and having a wife in another hospital who had just given birth, and having to deal with the issue of a young child, a baby a few days old, just passing away, it was a significant challenge for us. And we found out, after we buried our daughter, we found out that my wife had what's called groupy strep. Groupy strep is a bacteria infection, like strep, but instead of being in the throat, is in the vaginal area. And it can be passed on by a pregnant woman. It can be passed on to the baby as the baby is going through the birthing canal. And there are some telltale signs of having groupy strep: rupture of the membranes prematurely, early when you go into labor early, fever, a few other things. My wife had all of the signs of it, but the American College of Obstetrics did not require anybody to test for groupy strep, but the American College of Pediatrics always encouraged there to be those tests. So essentially, we thank God I have five beautiful children at home. But essentially, for two bags of penicillin that my wife would have received, two bags, let's assume they cost $50 a bag, $100, we would have a beautiful sixth child at home. I can tell you that the cost of the treatments, which is paper money because the insurance covered it, were way over $250,000 in the 2 days that she was alive, just from all of the things that she went over. It was paper money. We just got bills that were like phone books, and the insurance took care of it. $100 of antibiotics. So we went to the OBGYN, and we said, you know, can we just ask you one question? Next time that there is a woman who has all the signs of the beta strep infection, can you just test her for beta strep and put her on that antibiotic so that no family needs to go through what we've got through? And the OBGYN answered the following. I went into obstetrics because I don't like to deal with death, and I have no intention of testing the women who are in my or my patients in the future. We were devastated. We were devastated. I think in some ways it was worse than it was burying our child, knowing that she had basically died in vain. So we decided, I didn't decide, my wife decided. We decided that he's not gonna test, okay? Incidentally, other doctors had heard what we had gone through, and no one agreed to cover with him anymore. And he had to leave actually Boca Raton because he could not get coverage. There was no doctor that was willing to cover with him, no OBGYN was willing to cover with him. He can't run a practice as a solo practitioner when no one's going to cover for you. And he had to leave, he had to leave the community. My wife went to Tallahassee. She introduced herself to a local state senator whose name is Robert Wexler. Introduced herself, explained to her, to the state senator, the local state senator, who at that time they had no relationship with, what had happened to her. She refused to leave his office until something was done. He took her around to other senators, and within a period of 4 or 5 months, there was a law passed in the state of Florida that required every obstetrician, if there were any signs of beta strep, to test for beta strep. Incidentally, a tangent, that state senator became close friends with us, started to learn with him, we captured his home, his kids now go to day school, he became a United States congressman for 10 years or so, and we are still very close friends. We go to each other's smachot. I've spent Shabbos at his house, he's spent Shabbatot at our house. But the bottom line is that then what happened was that wasn't enough for my wife. She found others who had gone through the same thing. She went to the CDC, the Center for Disease Control. They created a branch of the CDC dealing with beta strep, group B strep. And it didn't just become a practice protocol for the American College of Obstetrics in the state of Florida. Over the next few years, it became a practice protocol throughout the country. And so I did very little, as most of the time in my house is the way it goes. And it's not a joke, it's the truth. My wife, this moved my wife. She made the decision that our daughter was not going to die in vain. And what she did was, she decided that she was going to make a difference. And not anymore, but for a good few years after that, we would get phone calls almost every single month from a mother thanking us for creating these practice protocols and how we saved her child from going through challenges. Sometimes it's not death, sometimes it's blindness, sometimes it's other things, but none of them are good. And to me, that in some ways represents, for me, when I saw my wife doing what she did, it reminded me of two things. First of all, we don't take our children for granted. That's something that we learned. And even to this day, when our five-year-old has something wrong with him and he has to go to the hospital, we just need to remind ourselves that we need to chill out, that hospitals are not automatically a bad thing for children. It's not always, you know, tragic. But we still need to take, even 16 years later, we still need to, you know, take a moment to do a little personal checkup about ourselves. It's still something that affects us. But what happened with my daughter and the way I can live with it is the fact that her one life and the few days that she lived, 3-4 days that she lived, made a difference in the lives of thousands and continues to develop thousands of babies who may have had the same bacterial infection, and now there's a new practice protocol that was established because one young lady, one young lady who was 31 years old, decided that the death of her daughter was not going to be something that was going to just be in vain. And to me, that is the Hasidic story about God hiding and finding God in those moments of darkness. It's about the Mistarim Tifked Nafshi, that God is crying in the closet, and you have to find God in those moments. And for me, since 16 years ago, the question for me is no longer why bad things happen to good people. Because there's no sin, there's nothing that my wife or I have ever done that would deserve the fact that we should lose a child. And there's no sin, there's no issue that we could ever do that my daughter should have to go through the pain and suffering that she went through the 72 hours that she was in the critical situation. And to be able to make a decision about life and death for your own daughter and call your Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Schechter, and he's crying louder than you're crying on the phone. You know, no one deserves that. But in that moment, what happened, what I realized was, the question is not why bad things happen to the people. That's the book of Job. We all ask the question, and there are no answers. The question is, when bad things happen to good people, what differences are we going to make in the world at that moment? Because that will define that will define the tragedy, that will define the moment of darkness, and that has the capacity to create light in the moment of darkness. And so, when bad things happen to good people, finding our response to adversity and tragedy is recognizing that even in the moments of darkness, there's a certain inner energy that we have. And if we can tap into that inner energy, we have the ability to transform the world. And at that moment, we define the moment even when there is adversity and even when there is tragedy. Comments.
We're going to daven Davimar, and then afterwards we'll have. Okay. Comments afterward. Unless there's somebody who wants to ask now. Thank you.